Last week we studied the letter to the church of Ephesus. That church during John's day and the church period from Pentecost to around 100 AD paralleled each other pretty well. Both had patiently endured hardship and defended God's truth against false teachers and worked sacrificially, but eventually only did ministry out of a sense of duty, and ministry became a chore, and they'd lost their first love. And we talked about, you know, getting our focus back on what was most important. And this week we look at the church in Smyrna. And this is a problem because you and I, we don't really have a way of identifying with the church in Smyrna. We truly have no frame of reference for what they are experiencing. I mean, as an intellectual exercise, it's fairly easy to talk about persecution and how we would deal with it and how we would overcome, and we would be really good Christians. But really, until you've experienced it, or some form of it, you have no idea. To us, persecution is we had to wait in line 20 minutes at the buffet. That's persecution, you know. Anything that just makes us uncomfortable. But the people in Smyrna were really being persecuted. And we tend to describe persecution as any time that we're, you know, inconvenienced. But the people... The persecution of Smyrna was far beyond that. Christians in Smyrna had lost everything. They couldn't work. They couldn't buy food. They couldn't be a part of society. They had lost their homes. And in many cases, they were left to live in caves or holes in the ground. And Smyrna is a church that has everything against it. And it's one of only two churches. They have everything against them. And in spite of that, they are one of only two churches that Jesus Christ has nothing bad to say about them. In fact, he says, keep going. The bad thing is, he says, keep going, it's going to get worse, which doesn't seem all that uplifting or all that encouraging. But he says, it's going to get worse, but you're going to come through the other side to a great reward. And which all of that kind of causes us to ask questions, right? Like, why do people persist when surrendering would save their lives? What keeps people faithful unto death? I mean, we really need to understand what it is that keeps people faithful in those situations so that we can kind of live and die well as ourselves. I mean, if we've not prepared ourselves to be ready to die for Christ's name, if it ever becomes necessary, then we're not really true followers of Christ. I mean, you have to actually at least think through it. Otherwise, we're just simply playing a church game. Only those who are gripped by something worth more to them than their own life can truly be courageous or truly overcome. And courage is precisely what Jesus calls the church to. In our passage of study today, courage is something that is desperately needed in the church, not just back in Smyrna, but today. We need to evaluate whether or not we agree with that unpopular truth that Jesus is better than life. The knowledge of Jesus and what he does for us must be bigger to us than the reality of death itself. We'll read today in the letter to the church of Smyrna that Jesus is the first and the last. He's the conqueror over death, the giver of the crown of life to those who are faithful. We'll explore what all that means. But it all really boils down to this. Jesus has to be bigger to us than the stuff on the outside. Jesus has to be bigger to us and more important to us than what death might mean. In Revelation 1:19, John was given a threefold outline of the book of Revelation that he was told to write. In Revelation 1:19, it says, write therefore the things that you have seen. That's the image of Christ in chapter 1. The things that are, that's the church age that John was living in, and those that are to take place, the events that will occur after the church age, whose description begins in chapter 4 and goes onward throughout the book of Revelation. And as you go through these letters, just the letters, you'll see a dual fulfillment that John was addressing specific situations in each church, current to the day he wrote them, but also how clearly they relate to definite periods of church history and various situations that crop up in every church that has ever or will ever exist. I mean, there is, in every age, there is a Smyrna. There's a Pergamum. There's a Philadelphia. There's a Laodicea. I mean, all these churches exist simultaneously all throughout history, but they also encompass different eras of history too. And the description of these churches also encompass or describe different Christians. I mean, these are individual descriptions of people's problems in their own faith. So this morning we're looking at the letter to the church of Smyrna, which amazingly parallels the period of church history from 100 AD to 312 AD. And this is the church persecuted. This is Revelation 2, 8 through 11. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last, who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. This letter to the church in Smyrna is all about Jesus. It may seem like the letter is about the suffering and the persecution the church in Smyrna is about to undergo, but from what Jesus says about that, it becomes clear that the suffering and the persecution are just a stage built for the enactment of the drama that displays the worth of Christ. Prophetically, Smyrna sets forth that age or stage in church history when the church was persecuted beneath the iron heel of pagan Rome. The persecution had begun in John's day, and therefore the letter also concerns itself with what happened to Smyrna at the time of John's writing. But from 100 to 312 AD, hundreds were brought into the amphitheaters of Rome to be fed to hungry lions and tigers, while thousands cheered their deaths simply because they were Christians. In 156 AD, Polycarp, the man who has the most unfortunate name in history, I think, the pastor of the church in Smyrna, and a man who had become a Christian under the Apostle John, is 86 years old at that point. And he refused to acknowledge Caesar as his Lord and renounced Jesus Christ, and was threatened to be burned alive. And his response is simply this: for 86 years I have served Christ, and he has never done me wrong. How can I blaspheme my King who saved me? And even though it was the Sabbath day, the Jews gathered sticks for the fire to roast Polycarp. And Polycarp stood there, tied to the stake, and as they prepared the fire, he said, "It is well. I fear not the fire that burns for a season and after a while is quenched. Why are you so slow? Hurry up, do your will." Polycarp's final prayer was gratefulness to the Lord to allow him to die for him. And his final words were simply, "I am a Christian." And to this Polycarp, and to these people who gave their lives for Christ, that explained everything they endured. That explained everything about their life. The faithfulness of Polycarp to the end seems to have characterized the church in Smyrna in its entire testimony and resulted in the church's continuous faithful witness for God after many others of the early churches had long lost their lives. J.H. Jowett, who was a pastor back in the 1800s, he said, "Ministry that costs nothing accomplishes nothing." Faith can be costly. Anyone who truly serves Christ has to be ready to pay that price. And that's what the church in Smyrna is describing. And for the most part, even the names of these seven churches have a role in their prophecy. The Greek word for Smyrna means suffering, and it comes from the word myrrh. Myrrh was a fragrant aromatic sap that was taken from a shrubby little tree and had this bitter taste to it. But it was a gum that could be extracted by cutting an incision into the bark of the trunk and the branches. And the sap would ooze out of the tree and drop onto these wooden squares or stones and to just solidify. And the process involved basically disfiguring this tree, torturing this tree. And the myrrh was this perfect symbol of the suffering and the blessing that can come from suffering. In order for this spice to give out this fragrance and this perfume, it had to be crushed and it had to be beaten. So you took this piece of hardened gum and you pressed it and you poured apart and you rubbed it and you crushed it. And that's exactly what's done to the church in Smyrna. It was crushed and it was beaten and it was persecuted, and it was in the midst of that bitter sorrow and suffering and was the most afflicted and persecuted of all the churches, and it is suffering just like the myrrh that was crushed and gave off this fragrant aroma. The suffering of the church in Smyrna was a fragrant aroma to Christ of what they were doing for him. This is Revelation 2:8. And the angel of the church in Smyrna write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. Jesus identifies himself as the first and the last who died and came to life. Think as far back as your mind will go. And Jesus was there before all of that. And I know most of our memories only don't even make it even back to the womb, right? But Christ was there. He is the first before all else that is. He is bigger than our ability to understand. He is also the last. Nothing will endure longer than Jesus. He is before and after everything. By identifying himself in this way as the first and the last, Jesus is explicitly claiming divinity. He cannot be preempted. He cannot be replaced by an emperor. Jesus goes on to say that he is the one who died and came back to life. Who would have imagined that a God, the God, could or would die? Willingly, voluntarily. He is before and after all that is, and yet he entered into the progress of history and was killed and rose from the dead. There are no categories in any other religion or philosophies of the world that match these ideas or these things that are in Christianity. The death and resurrection of Jesus mean that death has no power over him. He's bigger than death itself. And given what the Church of Smyrna faces, that reality is one they must keep in their minds if they are to be faithful. This letter to the Church of Smyrna is all about Christ. It may seem like the letter is about suffering and persecution that the church in Smyrna is about to undergo, but it becomes clear that in order to be faithful unto death, the knowledge of Jesus must be bigger to us than the reality of death itself. Jesus has to be bigger to us than death itself. When you think about the end of your life, do you apply to your contemplation the fact that Jesus has conquered death? When you think about dangerous situations you might face, the noise in the night that means an intruder might be in your home, the thought that someone you love could be lost, when you think of life-threatening danger, do you apply your thinking the triumph of Jesus over death? Applying to our fears the knowledge that Jesus is bigger than death, it can make you courageous. And courage is a great thing, but we have to keep in mind that courage is not our ultimate goal. Being seen as courageous has others look at us, right? It has them admire us, just like we admire, you know, what we read about the church in Smyrna, what we read about martyrs and the early church who did so many things. And we read about people in the church in China and these other persecuted churches. And this all falls short unless our confidence shines a bright light on Christ as the reason for our confidence, as the reason for that courage. Our ultimate goal is to live in ways that show our confidence in him. After Jesus announces himself in verse 8, he says in verse 9 that he knows three things about the church in Smyrna. He knows their tribulation, their poverty, and the slander made against them. This is verse 9. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. One of the most discouraging aspects or effects of suffering is that we feel alone. We feel lost and ignored. And when Jesus tells the church in Smyrna that he knows their tribulation, he's reminding them of his presence with them. He's reminding them that he's not asking them to do anything that he hasn't already done himself. The second thing Jesus knows is their poverty. The church was poor. There are two Greek words for poverty. One is the word paideia, which describes just poverty of the man who has to work to make a living. And that would describe most of us. I mean, if you don't go to work, you're not going to eat. And that's common. But the word for poverty here is toucheia, which means destitute. The implication is the person has nothing at all. There is nothing for them. These people were so poor that even the poor people thought they were poor. Because of their stand for Christ, they lost their jobs, their businesses, their social status, and were considered outlaws. I'm trying to think of a way to describe this. You don't realize this until you get older. And if you're under the age of 40, you don't get this yet. When you sit around with a bunch of other people that are like your age and older, like 40, 50 and up, you don't talk about really what you do during the day. You start talking about what's wrong with you, right? This hurts more, you know. And then it gets into a contest. You know, I hurt more. I take more medication than you do in the morning. And that's kind of what I'm always reminded of this with my mom's family. They used to get into arguments about who was poorer or more poor and all. And then my dad would come in, and they were really poor down in the South when he was growing up, and they just said, okay, you win. But this is my point. There's poor, and then there's just lacking everything, and that's what the church in Smyrna is. And they were in that condition because of their beliefs. They'd lost everything. They had had their homes plundered by vandals and thieves, and Romans had not lifted one finger to help them because of the stigma that was placed upon them. People felt they deserved this treatment. People hated the Christians in Smyrna for several reasons. One, Christians were considered disloyal to Rome because they wouldn't worship Caesar. Christians were considered atheists because they would not worship the Greek and Roman gods. They were considered atheists because they didn't worship enough gods. Who could possibly be religious if they only worship one god? Christians were accused of being cannibals because of misunderstandings about the Lord's Supper, about communion. They were accused of being immoral because of Paul's greeting of a holy kiss. Christians were accused of being homebreakers or home wreckers because of the division that was caused when one spouse was saved and the other was still lost in their sin. And the third thing that Jesus tells the church in Smyrna that he knows is the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. The Romans had granted the Jews an exemption from required participation in the Roman imperial cult, so they didn't have to make offerings to the emperor every year. In other words, the Jews didn't take part in the idolatry of Rome. Everyone else was required to participate, but the Jews were safe. They didn't have to do it. Emperor worship was started to unite the Roman Empire as a demonstration of gratitude to Rome for the peace and civility it brought to the world. But toward the end of the first century, under the Emperor Domitian, it went from voluntary worship to mandatory worship. And once a year, a Roman citizen had to burn a pinch of incense on the altar of Caesar. All they had to do was say, Caesar is Lord. And then they could depart to worship and any god that they wanted to. And they were given a certificate proving that they did this. And refusal to do that was an indication to the Romans that the person was disloyal to Rome and an outlaw. And without this certificate, they were seen as disloyal, which meant you couldn't be a member of a trade guild. You couldn't work, and you couldn't earn an income, and you couldn't purchase anything, including food. You had to be a member of one of these guilds. So if you forget about certificate, replace the certificate with mark. So you didn't take the mark of the emperor, so you couldn't buy and sell. And it's the mark of the beast that's described later on in Revelation. It's your devotion to one instead of the true God. So Christians quickly became poor and living in abject poverty, but Jesus says, but you're rich. And they may not have had a whole lot of coins, but he's saying, but you have crowns. And they live for eternal values that would never change, riches that could never be taken away from them. In fact, their suffering for Christ only increased their riches. The Jewish slander mentioned in verse 9 probably has to do with Jews denouncing Christians to the Romans. You see, as long as Christianity was seen as under the Jewish umbrella, Christians were also exempt from the required participation in the growing Roman emperor cult. If the Jews began denouncing Christians to the Romans, arguing they weren't Jews at all, Christians who refused to participate in Rome's idolatry, they couldn't work or buy anything. So Jesus denies the status of Jew to those who don't serve the Jewish king, Jesus himself. And they claim to be Jewish. Their claim to be Jewish is seen as a claim to be the people of God. And these people who were persecuting Christians were claiming to be the people of God and the children of Abraham. And the New Testament perspective, since the coming of Christ, is completely different. The true people of God are those who have recognized the Messiah and worship him, the Christians. They're the children of Abraham, the children of God. And this is a radical distinction that's now applied to the Jewish persecutors. And they claim to be God's people, but they're not. There are those who gather in synagogues to celebrate Satan's kingdom, not God's. And he identifies their true allegiance. He does this in John's gospel too. Jesus does this in John's gospel. He says, you're the son of your father, Satan, who is the father of lies. Jesus has announced himself as the first and the last who died and came to life. And he's assured them that he knows what they suffer and knows who their enemies are because of who he is and because he will be with them through the suffering. And they can, because of that, they can be free from fear. And this gets you to verse 10. He says, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He tells them, I know it's bad. And it's getting worse. It's just going to get worse. He tells them not to fear what they're about to suffer. The only thing that will keep the Smyrna Christians from fearing what they're about to suffer is their seeing that Jesus is bigger to them than death itself. There is none of this warm, fuzzy nonsense suggesting that maybe if the Christians were a little less dogmatic, less narrow-minded, weren't so hateful, weren't so judgmental, or maybe if they were more open to the possibility of there being more than one right way, they wouldn't be suffering. Everything would be okay. Notice that there is a purpose statement given in verse 10. Right after he recognizes who the enemy is, Satan, that you may be tested. The devil is about to throw some of you in prison that you may be tested. God is using Satan to accomplish his purposes. God is using the devil's persecution to test and to prove his people. And when his people come through the test, they make God look good, for only God could preserve them. And people saw Christians walking into the Colosseum in Rome, basically being fed to lions, and they held hands and walked into that, and they sang. And they prayed for the people that did that to them. And people saw that and they changed. Anyway, God has set a boundary here. There's a time limit placed on how long their suffering would last. 10 days. This specific mention of time has caused all ends of debate as Christians have tried to determine what it means. It could simply mean a literal period of 10 days, which doesn't seem quite right. But in chapter 1, we saw that some of the description of Jesus was framed with words from the prophet Daniel. And here, too, it is likely that the book of Daniel forms a background to what Jesus is saying through John. In Daniel 1, Daniel and his friends are making a stand against the pagan rulers seeking to serve King Nebuchadnezzar, and yet not compromising with his pagan world and his standards. And they refuse to eat the meat that's served and the food that's served. And then they set 10 days as a time for a feast to see if they would survive well without eating this food. And in many ways, Daniel and his friends serve as an example of all believers who withstood the pressures of pagan life and stood for the Lord in spite of the threat of death. They've been tested and withstood that test. And the persecution of these Christians from Smyrna can therefore be seen as part of God's test, and yet the period of testing is limited. It's not necessarily 10 periods of 24 hours, but it will certainly come to an end. That's the whole point of it. It will end. Just as it did for Daniel and his friends, because Christ is in sovereign control. The reward that Jesus promises is particularly suitable for those who may die for their faith. He says, I will give you the crown or wreath of life. The town of Smyrna was famous for its athletic games, and thus a reward of the crown of life would have reminded these Christians of the wreath prize given only to the best athletes and the best citizens. In life in Smyrna, these Christians were considered the lowest of the low, but the Lord of life will reward them with life itself, as you see in the promise which follows. Christ has a special crown for those who suffer. We all know people who have suffered in this life, whether it's through illness, through they were born into a bad situation, they ended up living someplace, they went to war, whatever, but they did suffer in life. If you're suffering at this moment and you've wondered if he cares, he has something for good for you in eternity. You will get something that no one else will be getting except others in your condition. God's word says in James 1, verse 12, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. That crown of life means that you are really going to live it up someday. And that's a glorious prospect for invalids and people who are born with different challenges, and for those on beds of pain today. And then Revelation 2:11, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death. Persecution cannot take away our eternal salvation, our protection, or those blessings. Dwight Moody put it like this. He said, he who is born once will die twice, and he who is born twice will die once. Suffering has a way of reminding us of which things in life really matter. Difficulty in life reminds us of what matters, because it forces us to depend radically on God, and thus purifies our obedience to God's will. If we've not prepared ourselves to die or to live and die for Christ's name if necessary, we've not completed our responsibility of being Jesus' followers. Like Daniel and his friends, we need to prepare for more strenuous future tests. I don't know, you say, well, how do we do that? We do it by passing the ones we're given in the present. When we remain faithful in the face of rejection or current what we would see as persecution today, the loss of a loved one that turns on us, rejects us, in that when we're obedient, we develop a confidence in Jesus, and it becomes to us bigger than the reality of death itself. And the reward that he promised to us is far greater than the power and the status that any of our oppressors now enjoy. we really have nothing to fear, but a lot to joyfully anticipate. The only exhortation that Christ gave to the church at Smyrna was, don't fear what you are about to suffer. He didn't say, you're not doing this right. He didn't say, but I have this against you. He said, keep going. History is filled with men and women who said no to destructive fear and changed the world. But imagine if they had given in to the paralyzing effects of fear on their lives. Imagine the Apostle Paul, fearing resistance or rejection, choosing to stay home rather than embarking on the missionary journeys that took the message of Christ throughout the known world. Imagine Martin Luther King Jr. giving speeches filled with gentle hints about the evils of segregation because he feared pushing too hard. Instead, King championed the civil rights movement against racial segregation in the United States. Imagine Rosa Parks during the same era in American history submitting to the bus driver's demands to give up her seat to a white person. Imagine Nelson Mandela looking the other way when he witnessed and experienced apartheid in South Africa because he didn't want to make a fuss. Instead, he spent 27 years imprisoned and brought apartheid onto the world's radar. Imagine yourself fully aware of the mission and vision God has placed in your heart to advance his kingdom in this world, and yet held hostage to phobias, irrational worries, and destructive fears of failure or harm or rejection or discomfort. And imagine if you don't fulfill the mission that God assigned to you. Who will? And if we all act that way, and if we all bend under whatever pressure we feel, where does it all go? If we do that, then we're just playing a church game. Like I said, when we started, we have no frame of reference for the church in Smyrna. We don't know what it means. We don't know what that, I mean, we can talk about it. We don't know what it really is to be persecuted. Well, I mean, we're going to get out of here and we're going to walk out and we're going to get in our cars, go to our homes that have air conditioning and heat and stoves and a microwave, because we can't be persecuted to have to wait more than 30 seconds for our food to be warm. And then you turn on the TV and you see pictures and see news reports of people being shot because they said something somebody disagreed with. Not because they were harming somebody, but because they said something people disagreed with. And because every time he went to a school, he preached the gospel, and people hated him for it. That's persecution. That's the world saying no to Christ. That's the world rejecting Christianity. That's the world rejecting the church. And what do we do with it? What do we do when we're faced with that? Do we just roll over, shake our heads, and make clucking sounds with our tongue and say, oh, that's too bad? Or do we consider what Christ means to us? And why are we being quiet about that? And why wouldn't we go out and share his good news and his gospel and the difference he's made in our lives with those around us? If we're not doing that, then we're just playing in a church game. Would you pray with me? Heavenly gracious Father, we are grateful today for your love, your grace in our lives, for all those blessings you give us. I pray, Lord, that you would help us to see the world through your eyes, to see what evil truly is, and to see the lost around us and to weep for them. And I truly have a heart for those truly have a heart for those who don't know you. And that we would make it an effort to share your good news whenever we were given the opportunity. We pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen.